Welcome to the Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards. The Reimagining Podcast is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which includes the Baltimore Wisdom Project and the Chicago Wisdom Project. Our shared mission is to reimagine education and reimagine the world by enhancing the lives of youth and adults with holistic education, intercultural understanding, and anti-oppressive, liberationist thought leadership.
In my dreams, there's wildness. One could say that there are two types of people, and I suppose what kind of person you are depends upon the civilization in which you come of age. Some dream of order. Mussolini would be a negative example of this type, in an Italy that had seldom been able to organize around anything, not even language. Il Duce created a political system, fascism, which cherished order above all else. Muhammad provides a more positive example, transforming the chaotic Arabian Peninsula into a coherent and great civilization through his holistic religious vision. But I don't dream about organized states or religion. Having grown up in a civilization in which controlling the wild is one of our most cherished values, indeed, we have paved over most of the world in our fear of the wild, I dream of wild places. For some, such dreams are terrifying. For me, they are beautiful. There's a balance between wildness and order, or chaos and cosmos, if you will, that any culture must find. Too much order leads to fascism. Too much wildness means a descent into violence and anxiety. Humanity has periodically encountered the wild in many contexts. We have always been a wandering species. We have tried to understand our world by constructing civilizations and creating cosmologies that allowed us to feel safe, to avoid the violence and anxiety to some degree. But it was always there. And always, there have been those among us who have left the safety of civilized life behind, who stepped out into the wild. This story begins before we were really even human, with the first apes who stood up and walked out onto the savannah. My own country, the United States, was founded through an encounter with a land that was somewhat wilder than the Europe its founders knew, and far more wild than our own imagination. The worldview I have inherited and rejected in my wild dreams is the product of our encounter with and rejection of wildness. So much of the American imagination has been shaped by this encounter. With an evangelical fervor that was all too easy for this Protestant nation to adopt, we made it our mission to conquer the wild. But what now? We've paved over the wild spaces, isolated the indigenous peoples, killed off most of the wolves and bears. Outer space is largely inaccessible. It seems that there's something in us that yearns for the wild again, something that needs the wildness even as we fear it. It seems that not only are the jungles and the forests and the bears wild, it seems that we are wild too, and we have paved over something in ourselves. Todd Hoskins' life and work centers around two things, relationships and transformation. In 2009, he launched Canopy Gap, an organizational design firm, which brought together his graduate studies in psychology, interest in network science and ecology, and experience working with organizations and leaders on transformation initiatives. Organizational design is about working with and relating more effectively as teams and networks. As a facilitator and coach, Todd has helped launch a dozen companies over the last 15 years and worked with organizations from NASA to Microsoft, universities, and nonprofits become more resilient, connected, and fully alive. He's part of the founding team for Sense Mapping, helping new practices and all our senses to the workplace. With wisdom guide Marty Spiegelman, he co-hosts the podcast and leadership program Leading from Being. Todd serves on the board of the Wisdom Projects, the Fierce Civility Project, and Project Realize. Todd and his family live in the sand dunes of Southwest Michigan with quirky artists and beautiful nature, enjoying tango dancing, being in community, writing, reading, and spending hours outdoors year-round. Welcome to Reimagining, Todd Hoskins. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Ted. Great to be here.
So today we're going to discuss a topic that I think is always worthwhile and kind of fundamental to the human experience, but it's one that is, I think, particularly relevant given much of what's happened, not only during the pandemic, but over the course of the last several years. And we'll kind of get into the details of that, but we're talking about uncertainty and how we as human beings cope with, process, and can understand uncertainty. So to begin with, Todd, I guess I'd like to ask you about, we'll use the word mess, okay? Because I think there's
I like that word.
It's a good word, right? And it's an underappreciated word. And I think we think of a mess, I think often in like an exclusively negative way, but I think there's like a lot of different ways to think about what it means, about what messiness means. So let's talk about it a little bit. So what is the mess that we're in, Todd? How would you describe it?
Well, I've been thinking about this, and you know, I talk about complexity a lot, and complexity is kind of an academic word, and it doesn't have a feel to it. You don't have a visceral reaction to complexity. Mm-hmm. You start thinking about math problems. And there's just this one day that I realized the mess is a way of talking about complexity and what I think of as uncontrollable uncertainty, because that's the world that we all recognize we're living in now. And I would say that that's the world that we have been living in, but we've been pretending, we've been under the illusion that there's some predictability, there's some assurances of control, or it's worth striving for control. But in the mess, we admit that we don't know what will happen, that we can't control outcomes, that problems seem to be connected to other problems, and we can't know the impact of our actions and choices. So there's a tinge of excitement to being in the mess, because it's a world full of surprises, but there's a lot of fear and anxiety that come with that as well. And we need to think differently and adopt a different set of skills if we fully embrace the mess.
Where do you think, so going way back to sort of like the real sort of essence of what it means to be a human being, I think, like, where does it come from, this resistance to uncertainty? Like, where do you think that urge to find order and make sense and kind of know what's going on, where do you think that comes from?
You know, I think we've been living for about 500 years in the Western world, post-Enlightenment, with the idea that the world is predictable, controllable, reducible to parts, and that we've been pretending we can tame the wild and be in control. This has affected day-to-day life. It affects fields from physics to education to economics, that we keep trying to break things down to understand them. And the prevailing metaphor there is one of a machine, which a machine, we've had machines for a long time, but they've become increasingly important. And the degree to which the machine metaphor is imprinted upon us comes out in things like biology, where I was taught in school that the mitochondria are the factories of the cell.
Mm.
That's not a living metaphor to say that something manufactures energy that's living within our body, or the brain is like the computer of our body.
Mm-hmm. Hardwired. Yeah. It's always people use it all the time. Yeah. That phrasing, hardwired in your brain. Yeah.
So if we look at evolutionary biology, Stuart Kaufman has said that life exists at the edge of chaos, or he would say that evolution happens on the edge between chaos and order. And so when I look at the last, I'm just roughly saying 500 years, we have been under the illusion of order, that we've been pretending that there is certainty, that not only is there complete order embedded in the universe, but our job is to create order. And that's not wrong. There is order within the complexity, and creating order is not a bad thing, but that pushing away of that other edge of evolution, that edge of chaos, it's harder to think about, it's harder to grasp what living in the mess entails, because we want this predictable order, or we want this return to normal. Part of what is in this pandemic age, the return to normal is give me the comforts that I once had. But it's not just the pandemic that is happening right now. We have a convergence of crises. A social justice crisis, an economic crisis, an ecological crisis. We have all these crises that are actually very deeply connected to the pandemic. And this return to order is not an order that sustains life on the planet. And so it's not about adopting just a new set of moral codes and orderly approaches. We need a different way of perceiving and being in order to live in the mess.
You identified 500 years as sort of a general kind of time frame for this, like, kind of hyper emphasis, over emphasis on order and control. And I think that we can identify a few different things: the rise of literacy and the Protestant Reformation. We can talk about the rise of capitalism. We can talk about colonialism, and particularly Western colonialism as it's spread across the world, and how that's sort of commingled with capitalism. And of course, the scientific revolution as well. So all of those sort of factors coming together, creating this like this civilization that has an emphasis. And all human civilizations have had some emphasis, as you point out, some emphasis on order. That's kind of how human beings get together and make sense of their world through their stories, through the symbols they use. But what seems to have been lost is this belief that there's also value in that wildness at the edge of order, and how those two things can balance each other out and are related to each other. And I think now during the pandemic in particular, I've thought a lot about that because we have this pandemic, which is really related to human incursions into these wild spaces, right? It's this,
yes.
Like, I mean, that's the issue, that we're increasingly entering into spaces that were wild, and that's where disease comes from. But I think there's also something that we're losing in the emphasis on, in the loss of wilderness, in losing this kind of wildness in ourselves, thinking of ourselves in two dimensions that you have on a screen of yourself, and how neat and orderly and nice you look on your Facebook page or whatever. But that's not really what a human being is. We're much more, to use your word, complex and messy, aren't we?
Yes. I mean, just a couple examples of that. You know, somewhere between 30 and 40% of the genetic material in our bodies is non-human. And so we are a community within us. We have a community within us of bacteria, different types of living organisms. And so even talking about the self, like, well, I'm me, that's orderly. I have an identity. I have a body. There's complexity there. Or if you take the, I would say, the frontier studies about the nature of the mind, and the people that I'm paying attention to, they've stopped trying to describe the physicality of the mind as an object. And we're not talking about the brain here, we're talking about the mind. And interpersonal neurobiology talks about the mind as an emergent, self-organizing, and relational process. And it starts to blow your mind a little bit if you start to think of your own mind as not a thing, not an object, but a process. And that's part of being in the mess, is we're in this longer transition from seeing the world as objects, and then from a network perspective, seeing nodes and then links between the nodes, but the nodes are what are important. And now moving towards seeing the world as relationships, and there are beings in relationships. So it's not that it's only relationships, but the relationships are actually what are driving a lot of the processes and transformations in the world, not the objects. And so the mind as emergent, self-organizing, and relational, and as a process, these things are helpful to, it's not like we need to fully grasp them on the first read, but to open to a space in which we see that there's much more than meets the eye. And there's simultaneous dynamic relationships happening that are in motion and they're shifting. And when we see the world less as objects and see all of this movement, it starts to free us a bit slowly. And it's going to take a while. This is not something you can read a book, go to a workshop, and just say, we're free from that. And especially at a cultural level. But this process has already started, from shifting from objects to relationships. And the planet needs it right now, because we view the planet as separate from us. We view nature as separate from us. We're expected to be like a machine. We expect ourselves to be like a machine. We compete, we think we are competing for scarce resources, and that we're either in control or being controlled. And all of these things are fundamentally incomplete. There is some underlying truth, but they're incomplete. And so we need a new narrative.
You know, the idea of relational process, of ourselves as a relational process, I think one of the challenges we have as a species is both world and self, how we understand those things. I think part of the issue of like of this sort of notion of control and delusion of certainty that we've that we're clinging to, it feels like it's related to a sort of like more narrow and concise and fundamentally limited notion of what the self is and what the universe is. The universe itself as a whole is a relational process. The universe is not a place, it's an event. And each of us is that too. I think we each are fundamentally relational. You mentioned the notion of a narrative, right? Because we're sort of telling stories right now, and we're using metaphors to understand things that are fundamentally impossible to understand without this kind of language. You use the machine metaphor, and we talk a lot about that in kind of the way at Wisdom Projects, we talk a lot about kind of the way that our educational process, again, education itself is a relational process. I was talking to folks about this just yesterday about how when we're thinking about education, we so often just talk about the stuff that we're supposed to learn, but actually it's in the process and in relationships that we do the learning. We need a new narrative. How can we get there with, say, a system like an education system that is entirely geared toward, not, this is not the only metaphor that's at play, but it's one of the core metaphors, I think, is this machine metaphor. That's how we teach our kids. You know, I can recall being in a public school growing up and being in this kind of like factory system in which they would stick you in a classroom and they'd deposit the math into you. And then you'd go on the conveyor belt to the next classroom and they'd deposit the social studies into you. And that was, you were supposed to be fully educated at the end of the process. But of course, the stuff you learn was really not there. It was trying to navigate the lunchroom and figure out how to skip class and all those other things. That's where you really learn things, I think, right? Kind of subtle or not so subtle kind of social stratification that played out in the way that people were tracked in certain classes and how you navigated those social relationships. That was the real learning for me that happened in school growing up. How do we incorporate messiness and uncertainty into our way of kind of thinking about education? What do you think about that?
Oh, wow. We could devote a whole episode to that. So first, I think it's keeping a check on how the old narrative starts to influence what we do. And so if we are observing as outsiders, not participating, if we are in the process of analysis, dissection, categorizing, diagnosis, prescription, or fixing, none of those are bad things. They've all benefited us in incredible ways, but again, they're incomplete. So keeping an eye out for how much of that is happening. And then when you talk about the relational process and what does it mean to live interdependently or to learn emergence or to be in a state of interconnectedness? Well, we all, from a scientific perspective, there's across fields, there's more and more understanding of how deep the interconnectedness is and the interdependence. And with emergence, this idea that if we're in a relational process, surprises happen. Stuff emerges from relationship. Emergence requires an openness to possibility. And so the more that we can lighten the rigidity around topics, lessons, anything that is hard and fast, there are facts in the world. Those are important to know. That the facts themselves are not what is going to make us be in relationship with this planet in a long-term way. The facts won't get us there. The relationships will. So our own relationships with emergence, part of that is permission to be in a state of exploration, permission to be who you are in the context of others. And I would love to see education. And if you look at what's happening in the Scandinavian school systems where they're loosening the hold of subject-related studies. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what's beautiful about it is not that they're letting something go. They're creating the conditions for people to be in a state of learning. And that's different than I'm going to teach you versus as a teacher, I am going to create the conditions that maximize your capacity to learn. And I think we need to, beyond education, we need to talk more about what does it take to create those conditions at a community level, teams with families, to create those conditions where people can explore, express, experiment. And it's actually not incredibly hard to do other than the breaking of old habits.
Which is a hard thing to do, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And I think maybe that line between what different subjects need to be broken down a little bit, perhaps the line between where learning happens and doesn't happen, or where what are learning spaces and aren't learning spaces needs to happen as well. I mean, I think that if we limit our thinking about learning and education to schools, I think that's probably, we're probably missing out on a lot there. We're going to take a quick break now, and we'll be back in a moment.
Our statement of intent. 1, the planet and humanity are at a moment of crisis and opportunity and of transition. 2, because we are entering into an unknown future, imagination is paramount. 3, this moment requires new stories, new narratives, new creative works that express this reimagining. 4, we believe that these narratives must challenge and confront the injustices of our day. 5, crisis of the moment is an educational crisis. That is, we must reimagine educational processes in order to reimagine our narratives. 6, we welcome educators, poets, philosophers, activists, and writers who are interested in reimagining ourselves and our relationship to the planet. 7, reimagining is a place not so much to find quick answers or definitive solutions, rather it is a place to ask big questions, to explore possibilities, and to imagine a new world. You can find more about our work at www.reimaginingmagazine.com and more about our broader mission at www.chicagowisdomproject.org and www.baltimorewisdomproject.org.
I'm talking to Todd Hoskins, and we are considering uncertainty and messiness in the world today. Thanks for being here, Todd. So we were sort of laying out what the mess is that we're in and kind of how we got here, and talked a little bit about perhaps how we might think about educating for a different narrative. But I'd like to talk about, really kind of envision in this these last few minutes, like envision what we really need going forward to really embrace uncertainty and to look differently in uncertainty, and to really kind of figure out how we can flourish and thrive in an uncertain world. You know, I think some of that has to do with sort of letting go of the notion that the world was ever as certain as we wanted it to be, for sure. So let's talk about what really leads to thriving when we can loosen our beliefs in kind of like the simplicity of cause and effect. What do you think about that, Todd?
Yeah. So we're so accustomed to using our cerebral capacity and our ability to strategize. And we think that we should be able to plan our way out of any situation. And part of being in the mess is that there's a place for thinking and strategizing, but there needs to be a reorientation towards what are the dynamics that are currently at play. And there's a relationship between dynamics and outcomes. And I just want to talk about that a bit, because mm-hmm. we say outcomes in an educational context, we know what that is, and you know they're all measurable. But if we remove that everything in the world is a simple cause and effect, and say that there's all of these factors and variables at play, and it's not just objects, there's relationships, there's energy, there's dynamics at play, there are certain outcomes that emerge that are life-giving, and certain outcomes that emerge that are not life-giving. And so I'll name a few: happiness, well-being, health, empathy, trust. None of those things, it's my experience and my belief, none of those things you can create a plan to get yourself to happiness, or create a plan to get yourself to a full state of well-being, or even create a plan to become more full of empathy. So these are outcomes that occur through this interplay of my relationship with myself, my relationship with my environment, my relationship with others, and all of the dynamics at play. And so one of the outcomes, interestingly, of being in a world that's been focused on machines and objects is that we've ignored the energy and the dynamics. And that's messy. Like, how can I measure that? Well, you can't really. And measuring anything, the moment you measure it, it's in the past. You're not measuring. We don't have this capacity to measure something in the present. As soon as it's measured, it's in the past. It's interesting. I was watching Infinite Potential, the film about the life of David Bohm. And he had this moment on stage when he talked about that this coming paradigm of science will be beyond measurement. But try telling the scientists, and many of them are moving in that relational direction, but imagine a world without measurement. Imagine a scientific world without measurement. It's not that measurement's not important. It's that there's other things at play. The dynamics you can take a pulse of, you can feel into, you can read, you can have dialogue about it. But the dynamics are always shifting.
I was going to say there's a certain way that as in quantum physics, when as soon as we begin to measure something, we alter it, right?
The observer effect, yes.
Yeah. So I think that's true with something such as, I don't know, happiness. If we try to measure it, we're changing what it is, you know, and we're sucking the joy out of it too, I think, in the process.
Yes, yes. So we know within dynamics, they're visible, but they're invisible. They're impossible to measure, but when you walk into a room, you have a feel for the room. Can you describe what that feel is? Sometimes you don't. Sometimes you may be able to, but we have this capacity to read, to feel into the dynamics. And we know that there's a lot of sociological studies being done on the contagion effect, that we know that the dynamics and these states of being, they impact one another. So if I walk into a room and I am full of rage, I may not have to say anything or do anything explicitly, and people may consciously or unconsciously feel that. That is existing at a scale to which we don't fully comprehend, at how much the dynamics and the other people's states and the state of the planet is affecting us. So moving to a place where creating those conditions so that those more life-giving outcomes can emerge partially has to do with what are the little things that we need to do to bring the dynamics of a family, a community, a team to states that are resonant, full of vitality, with a greater awareness and creative. Because I believe that that's where the great hope is, not in some grand master plan, which is not going to create a fix for the injustice, for climate change, for economic inequality, all of those things. We need some favorable dynamics.
I think, and this is only one element of it, but I think one of the issues with this failure to understand, or this oversimplification of kind of cause and effect, you know, I look at these like kind of new age spiritual beliefs like that we create our own reality. Well, we sort of do, but the problem is we don't do it as individuals. I mean, if there ever was like sort of like a spirituality for consumer capitalist civilization, it's that, the notion that we individually get to select the reality that we have. Well, we're creating our reality, but we're doing it as part of an interconnected web that extends to every single event and individual being in the universe. So that gets a little messy and complicated then when we think about the reality we have. And the notion that we as individuals can sort of just like decide that we're going to like create some sort of isolated alternate universe on our own is I think it is the product, in part at least, of that kind of like hyper-individualism of our late capitalist civilization. So if the outcomes we're seeking, there are things that can't be planned for. If we can't simply say, well, this five-step program to get to I was in a dialogue with some folks who are trying to create an ecozoic education program. And there was sort of a split in the discussion. Some folks were wanting, almost leaning, and I say this, you know, with generosity, but almost leaning to like, this was not the perspective they were coming from, but it was easy to see where it would lean toward this almost eco-fascist sort of like, we need to get everyone on board because we're in this mess and we have to fix it really fast. We have to like figure out how to get people to understand the problem and have very specific solutions to the problem. And then the other side of it was, well, unfortunately, that works really well to create a fascist state. It doesn't work so well when you're trying to create a civilization that's more just and compassionate and sustainable, right?
Yes.
So let's talk about that a little bit. Like, what are the kind of like if we can't necessarily plan for the outcomes or create like a easily kind of canned curriculum to get to that outcome, like what are the paths and principles that, like, how do you see those are principles that we should base ourselves on?
Yeah. And the principles that I work with are not exhaustive and they're not my own. They come from many different traditions, but I think we have to start first with a conversation about safety, because it's incredibly important that people's nervous systems are regulated. Ideally, they feel a sense of belonging, but that feeling of safe. And right now, culturally, we're not having the right conversation about safety. The conversations around cancel culture, I sense that a lot of it is people don't want to feel uncomfortable. We've lost the distinction between when am I uncomfortable and when am I unsafe. Our body knows the difference and we can read that, but we need a capacity to move into discomfort and we need to create conditions of safety. And for me, like, safety is, you know, there's room to fail, there's consent involved. Thoughts, feelings, experiences are welcome and harm is repaired. And this conversation around safety is incredibly important right now because we're dealing with injustice, with inequality, with a lack of appreciation for diversity as being the driving force of evolution overall and what makes things strong. And the healing part of this, that harm does need to be repaired and we need ways outside of the court system, our current legal models of repairing harm at every level in communities, in families, in society writ large. So that safety is so incredibly important. And the discomfort, I think we need more capacity to live in that discomfort because that's part of being in the mess, is we admit that we don't have control. So, but beyond that safety, there are certain states of being that are mutually reinforcing. And I look at vitality, at awareness, at creativity, and resonance. If I am in a state of awareness where I'm seeing, I'm noticing more, I'm more creative. If I'm in a state of resonance where my heart is moved and I'm open-hearted, I feel more alive. There's more vitality. When I'm feeling creative, I can go much longer in my day. I don't need as much rest. These mutually reinforcing states, these dynamics also exist at the collective level. They're not just individual. And so instead of creating a plan to get from point A to point B, which is not bad or wrong, we also need to be looking at how do we improve the dynamics in relationships so that that planning is more effective. We're less dependent upon it. We're more adaptive. We're more flexible. We're more compassionate and we're more energized.
I mean, it strikes me as these are wonderful sort of principles around which to think about how to organize a classroom or a home, you know, and have these kind of conversations. Is one of the challenges distance and speed with which the internet and social media in particular pushes these dialogues, these conversations along? It feels to me like I could certainly envision a classroom in which everyone felt safe and in which there was some room for disagreement and rich dialogue, right? I could envision that happening. You know, I can say as an educator at different levels, all the way from little kids to graduate students, I've never been in a space where I think wasn't safe for disagreement to happen. But I think that I'm also on Twitter. And as you are, I think we met on Twitter actually.
Yeah, which is, that's where we met.
So that speaks well to something about Twitter. And I actually like a lot of the conversations that happen on Twitter, to be honest with you. I'm not saying it's all bad, but I also know it can be really toxic. And it feels like the culture in general is moving in a more toxic direction. I don't know if you have anything to say about that, but it feels like it's a really tough challenge, even harder than just dealing with people face to face, right? You're dealing with them in these kind of social media spaces that are like really out of control.
Yeah, that's another topic. My friend Ted Wallach calls it anti-social media. And yeah. I think of that all the time. Well, it's been valuable to me too, but it also can suck the life out of me. So if we go back to that hidden assumption that we are productive, and that this goes for the classroom too, this assumption that we need our students to be productive, we need to be able to prove what information they're learning. And we're just adding to, we're not saying don't be productive. We're not saying that's not important, but we're looking on what brings these kids or these adults or these groups, these teams and communities, what brings them fully alive?
Mm.
Because if they're fully alive, they're also going to be more creative. If they're more creative, it's going to make their awareness increase. And if their awareness is increased, you know, there's going to be more resonance. There's going to be more chances to expand beyond just that community and impact other communities. So there's the dynamics don't just magically appear, and they can't necessarily be planned for, but there's pathways to getting there, and there's principles that can be applied, and it requires a little bit of creativity. It's not a blueprint. There's no way to make these outcomes or dynamics occur.
Yeah.
So you got to be in a path of experimentation. You got to be in a path of practice, of inquiry, of identity, asking who we are, not just once, but again and again. Who are we as a group? Who are we as a collective? Who am I as an individual?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, go ahead.
There's nothing more stifling to learning than like the need to have control and certainty of the educator, right? There's nothing more stifling to the student than an educator who has to be in control and has to have like certainty about what's going to happen, right? It occurs to me that like these notions of like having an outcome or having a particular goal in mind is, it's not that they're wrong, but they ought to be secondary, and that what's primary ought to be the relationship, and
yes,
the other things arise out of that.
Well said.
We talked about the principles. I mean, I wanted to talk about, give you a chance to describe kind of like what really powers this movement that you're describing. I'm going to call it a movement because we're talking about like a really different way of approaching life. And, you know, I've mentioned education sometimes because we talk about it here on the podcast, but I think it's also really just about an approach to life and big picture kind of questions and how we can reimagine our place in the world. I'll often go into spaces and I'll ask people when they learn the most in life, and they'll describe some experience. And I follow that up by, when is the moment that you felt the most alive? And almost always they'll say the same thing. It's always the same time. When someone's feeling most alive is often their greatest learning experience. So,
yes.
And that kind of speaks to what you were saying. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, we've got just a bit of time left, but I'd like to hear, you know, what are the core kind of like principles behind your work?
Yes. I work in this nascent field of organizational design. So how do we work and relate in ways that bring about the outcomes we want? New ways of working together, new ways of relating. And we talk about principles because it's important to remember how much wisdom is context-based. And I've been having a number of conversations with indigenous elders, wise people, native peoples, and I get this idea that part of the translation of language difficulties from Anishinaabe to English, for example, is that they're more verb-oriented languages often, and the knowledge or wisdom is often context-based. Well, our temptation is that we're going to find out what the rule is to make it work and the steps to make it happen. And so principles are important, in because you look at anything that's working well, that's bringing a state of well-being, then now we need to look at what are the underlying principles at work here. And so there's some consistency of these principles, and then there is specificity of how and when and where you apply them. And some of those principles we've already talked about, such as discomfort, the importance of that. I think we've talked a little bit about acceptance, that so often acceptance of what actually is a launching pad for what is new. We've talked a bit about diversity, and I'll mention some others, and pleasure as a principle, that bringing people together in a state of pleasure can help bring about that awareness, vitality, resonance, and creativity. Embodiment as a principle, what can we do that takes us out of just our heads and gets us active with our bodies? Beauty is a principle, that aesthetics may be a personal matter, but also beauty has a capacity to move the soul and also increase our awareness, vitality, resonance, and so forth. Narrative, we've talked about today. Reciprocity, balancing, clarity, one that is misunderstood, that we need to turn things into rules. Really, the principle of clarity is about being able to bring things to a point that doesn't encompass the whole, but encompasses the now. And so we see that often with teams and such, and the ability to come together and start a meeting with a focal point, or to come to an agreement. That agreement may change, but having that clarity is important. And then just a couple others: sovereignty, which is a whole conversation, invitation, and participation, which I think is one of the most important, in that when I am in a state of participating with my colleagues or with all that is, when I'm on a walk out in nature and I feel like I'm a participant in the living process, I'm not just an observer, I'm participating, magic sometimes happens. And creating environments for educators or for leaders, creating environments that create more room for participation. The more voices can be heard, more beings can be seen and valued. You know, there's technology can be a huge asset in this regard, that we talk about crowdfunding, crowdsourcing, all of these things. We have ways of bringing more participants into sense-making, decision-making, and that needs to happen, especially at a level of governance. So those are some of the principles we work with, and they're not magic fixes. There are no fixes in the mess. There are experiments that lead to hopefully new dynamics, and then you need a state of dialogue and sensing to continue to try new things, experiment, and not get stuck in object or objective related paths.
Todd, it's been great talking to you. And I want to say that I feel more alive than I did when this conversation started. I feel like really when we think of like what it means to be in the absence of uncertainty, in the absence of messiness, is to no longer be alive. And so, yes. And there's a real beauty and joy in the mess. And I think that it's in messiness where we find authentic relationship, we find love, we find struggle, but also we find the joy in life. So I want to thank you for reimagining that uncertainty with us. And thank you for all your work.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ted, for hosting this Reimagining podcast. All the episodes I've listened to are great. I hope more people get to hear it.
The Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated. Original music by Cosmos Ray. Sound engineering by Jim Qualick. Thank you for listening and for reimagining with us.